Hello and welcome to University Registrars Talking About Stuff. This is a series of podcasts featuring two University Registrars talking about higher education matters. Dave Hall of the University of Leicester and Paul Greatrix of the University of Nottingham talk through a number of topics, including the role of the Registrar, some key responsibilities of the job, and Dave's career trajectory from the Army, rebellion in the ranks, and then to sabbatical officer and ultimately University Administrator and Registrar. The shared Warwick experience, both registrars worked at the University of Warwick for a period, and their very small part in organising the visit of Bill Clinton to the University, and other aspects of the Warwick Way are also covered in this podcast. There's a surprising encounter with Jeremy Vine, along with some other, perhaps rather curmudgeonly, observations about life in higher education today. Do enjoy. So this is a podcast which as yet doesn't actually have a title, but the working title is Registrars Talking About Stuff, and there are two registrars in the room at the moment. One is Dave Hall, who's Registrar and Chief Operating Officer, to give him his full title, at the University of Leicester currently, although we'll be moving to the Open University in a few months' time. And I'm Paul Greatrix, and I'm Registrar at the University of Nottingham. And we're going to talk about higher education stuff and see where it takes us. There aren't many podcasts out there with registrars talking about anything to do with higher education. There is an American one from the Association of American College Registrars and Admissions Officers, or ACRO. They talk about registrarial stuff, but it's a bit American and, you know, a bit serious. And I think we're possibly not quite as serious or as capable as the ACRO people. But we'll find out, won't we, Dave? Yes, we will.
Yes.
So one of the things that I always get asked is what do you actually do? What is a registrar's role? What's it all about? How do you fill your time? So when people ask you at, you know, dinner parties or awkward social events, what do you do? What do you actually tell them?
Oh, well, I was thinking of describing the role in the context of day-to-day. I think most of my time is actually spent being asking questions or being asked questions. It's a very person-focused experience. At times, it extends from feeling like you are someone who is trying to help people with all of their problems. I was going to say agony aunt, but I don't know if that's an appropriate phrase. But that's sometimes how it feels. And trying to get people to be clear about what it is they've got an issue with. And so, almost trying to draw out of them something that isn't necessarily apparent.
So it's I mean, agony aunt is one way of looking at it, but I mean, that sounds like a kind of very much a kind of facilitator, constructive critic, helpful friend, you know, kind of almost a kind of literary critic kind of role. Or are you doing it face to face?
So it's a lot of it's face to face. A lot of it, obviously, these days are over email. But what I was trying to emphasise is the personal interrelationships with others, which takes up 80% of the job. And if we come on to things that are frustrating, what's distinct about the job, I think, of others, which might where I think you can get quicker satisfaction, is you can never really see what you've done or achieved.
Yeah, it's a very, very long game, isn't it?
Yeah.
And a largely invisible one.
Somebody might say thank you, but you can't see a nicely carved cabinet at the end of it or anything like that. And it's not always known that that's what you're trying to do.
Yeah. So it's a job of infinite subtlety, then, is I think what you're suggesting as well.
I think it is. I don't think it's about just telling people what to do and issuing instructions or asking for information. You're trying to get other people to do the right things, find information for themselves, and to come to you with both the problem and their thoughts on a solution.
Yeah.
And what they're asking you to do is, in a sense, sense check it. That's in an ideal world. There'll be other colleagues, of course, who come to you and you know, they just want you to sort something out for them or give them clearer direction, and that's fine. That's all part of the job as well. It's just a lot of that and less of actually doing something. I feel I've actually done something if I've crafted a paper for a committee. That feels like I can, and I do that these days far more rarely than I used to.
No, I know exactly what you mean. I mean, one of the reasons I started writing a blog was because I was conscious I didn't write anything these days, hardly. So, you know, I used to write a lot of papers when I was earlier in my career, but I was worried I wouldn't be able to keep writing if I didn't keep writing, because you're just editing other people's stuff.
Yeah.
But you say you do a lot of face-to-face. I mean, in the electronic age, an awful lot of stuff seems to be online, email, you know, various electronic communications.
Yeah, I don't know whether I'm overstating this, but even when I'm dealing with emails, normally all the information that you need isn't there, and I don't mean that's about facts. It's about why is someone expressing something in a certain way?
Yeah.
Why is somebody frustrated? Why are they struggling with something? Why have they got a certain perception on something or somebody? And it's getting behind. It's getting behind whatever it is superficially facing you.
Yeah, yeah.
That's more about understanding people's motivations, their fears. It normally a lot of the challenges, and when you've got staff who may be struggling with a role or frustrated in their job, there will be things around power, status. Tiny things can upset people, and I think I have to be careful how I handle colleagues, but often it's colleagues coming to me because they've been slighted by someone.
Yeah.
In ways sometimes you think, well, in helping them look at it from a different perspective, that everybody isn't out to get everybody else, although it can feel like that sometimes. It's just the banging together of people.
Yeah, there's a lot of banging together goes on in higher education. So on that point about power then, I mean, I always remember, and we'll talk about this at some point, but one of the things John Baldwin, who's former registrar at the University of Warwick, always said when people asked him, well, John, are you ever going to be a vice-chancellor? You know, because very few registrars do go on to be vice-chancellor. And he always said, sort of half-jokingly, I think, you know, why would I give up all the power? I mean, there is a perception, isn't there, that registrars are, like, really powerful and, you know, pull all the levers and pull all the strings. I have to say, I've never felt that. I don't know how you see it.
No, I don't. I don't think that's fair or reasonable. I think there's a context when you have got responsibility. I'd rather think of it in that context than power. You carry a lot of responsibility in terms of the staff, your colleagues, certainly in the professional services, feeling that there's someone on their side, that there's someone who's got a clear view about what the general role and direction and strategy for the services are, as well as for the institution, someone who can articulate how the work of the professional services fit in with the academic mission of the institution, how we enable it. I think they're looking to you for all that.
Yeah.
And as I say, they're looking for you to be on their side at times as well. There's a lot of times when there's criticism is unfair, obviously sometimes when it is perfectly reasonable. But it's that responsibility is, I feel that much more strongly and heavier weight than thinking that I've got power. I've got power in the sense that I can decide to come in 10 minutes late and leave 10 minutes earlier. So, but it's almost as trivial as that at times.
Yeah, yeah. Well, how did you end up in your role then? Because you recently published a wee biography on the AHUA website, but it didn't, which explained a bit of your career trajectory, but it didn't really explain how you ended up where you are.
I was arrested at one point, and the judge gave me a couple of options. One was 10 years in Wandsworth Prison, I think it was, and the other was to serve in the university administration.
So it's a pretty stark choice.
and I took prison, but he had no sympathy with me, and he sent me off. How did I end up where I am? When I was at school, from my earliest stage, you want me to go back that far?
Yeah, go on.
Yeah. My earliest memory
always dreamed
is of it was to join the army.
Yeah,
I felt it was important that we all learn how to kill each other, and I wanted to get an early experience of that. So
other people just played with soldiers.
Yes, yeah, yeah, but I was dressing up and everything. Yeah. I had a chair leg in which, you know, I used to rush around the garden shooting neighbours. So when I was at college, and I wasn't interested in getting A-levels or anything, I just wanted to get in the army, and I didn't need any academic qualifications. However, I trundled my way through college and got a couple of A-levels. Nothing that would get me into a good university these days. And instead, you know, I had a row with a girlfriend and walked into an army careers office. So no doubt this is how these things happen. I couldn't speak French, so the Foreign Legion was out of the question. And it ended up, literally, you know, you go into an army careers office and a few weeks later you can't turn back, sort of thing. So I went into the army and then realised after a couple of years that it was dull, if anything else.
Yeah. I mean, you didn't get to kill anyone then?
I don't think so, actually.
No, it's probably for the best, yeah, isn't it?
We, it gets a bit repetitive because I was only an infantry soldier, and I didn't particularly want to progress. And actually, I became quite politicised, and I was quite interested in the Troops Out movement. I got involved with some.
That's a bit difficult if you're a troop in and you're interested in the Troops Out.
Yeah, well, we'd spent time in Belfast, and I was sceptical about the reasons for us being there, and got involved with writing to Crass. Remember that?
Oh gosh, yeah.
So I wrote to Crass, and had some really thoughtful correspondence with them, and I didn't know what I was doing, but that inspired me to actually get out of the army and go to university. At the time, I thought I'd try and apply to the Open University, yeah, funnily enough, but I was too young. You had to be 21 at the time.
Yeah, to be mature, yes.
So I had a very helpful army education officer who took me through the process, and I ended up applying to the University of Reading. In the meantime, I was on a promotion carder to be a lancejacker, a corporal. And as part of that process, you had to write an essay. I mean, most of us, certainly a lot of the other chaps, hadn't written an essay in their lives. And my essay was based on why we needed to get out of Ireland and why Britain was a fascist state. And obviously this caused some concern with my commanding officer. Yeah. And I was pulled off exercise to go and see him. And, not everybody was happy about what I'd done. And he was sympathetic. He was supporting me going to university. He suggested I read Rousseau or something. I mean, it was... Yeah. And, you know, they waved me off. And in the end, I brought myself out and went to Reading. And when I was at Reading, I was expecting a really politicised environment because I was all ready for that. And, of course, it wasn't like that at all. It was all very downbeat and home counties and all that sort of thing. And I'd had a promise.
And this was the mid-80s, wasn't it?
This is the mid-80s.
So post-miners strike and...
Yeah, it was very quiet. And I'd left the army on a promise from a sergeant, Sergeant Patterson, who we fondly called Kill 'em Dead Patter. And he had said, look, Dave, we'd known each other for a number of years, but if I'm guarding a nuclear weapons site, as we did at one point, and if you're protesting, I will have to shoot. I was like, oh, thanks. It's good of you to be at front about
it. At least you know where you stood.
Yeah. But anyway, so when I got there, I ended up standing for president of student union.
Yeah.
And on a ticket, and no cuts, students against cuts and all that sort of thing, and was involved for a while with the Associates Workers Student Society, because they were prepared to go and put my leaflets out, which was very kind of them. And then I got elected to the student union presidency in 1989 at Reading.
And then you immediately compromised your principles in order to take the take the shilling of the vice chancellor, I see.
Well, it was a good time. It was a time when grants were just being abolished. So yeah, there was a massive demonstration in London.
Yeah.
And this was my first experience of the horror and misery of leadership, because we all took a couple of coaches and students down to London, and it was the Battle of Westminster.
Yeah, Rugby, yeah.
I don't know whether you remember that.
Oh yeah.
And we all get off the coach, and of course no one knew where to go. And they expected me, as the union president, to know where to go. And it was that moment of dawning horror when everybody was looking to me to know what to do. And that is the job thereafter, you know, that the people look to you to know what you're supposed to do.
So presumably you hadn't bothered to check what was going on. So you learnt a very valuable lesson about leadership from that.
I think maybe there was a clue that I might one day be a registrar because I had taken an A to Z with me.
So very, very prescient, very prescient. So you did that for a year and then you started working at the university or a different university?
Yeah, I worked at Reading for a while in the accommodation office. And this was a time when we used to recruit too many students for the number of bed spaces we've got, so that when some students left, you could always keep your bed spaces full. Obviously, that became a scandal, but I was working in the accommodation.
Yeah, very practical. Yeah.
And actually, during that time, Jeremy Vine came round to interview us because we were having students being put up in family homes. We had to advertise locally, say, please, can you take in a student because we've over-recruited.
Everyone loved those stories, yeah.
And Jeremy Wine came round and we went to the house of a woman who was acting as a landlady.
Yeah.
And she got young children and the children had put all their paintings out on the floor in the kitchen. Very nice.
Nice.
Lovely. And she said, mind the paintings. And so Jeremy walked right across all of them. They stuck to his feet.
Oh.
Whether he'll remember.
I'm sure it's etched on his brain. Yeah.
But after doing that, I applied for a number of jobs. And one of them was to work at the University of Warwick.
Yeah.
And that was for the grandly titled administrative assistant.
That was in the days when everyone had to start as an administrative assistant,
yep.
Didn't they? Yeah.
And yet you worked your way up till you were administrative
officer. And then it was assistant registrar, then senior assistant registrar, yep. And then goodness knows what happened next.
Yeah. So that was first job, was working on the distance learning MBA program for the University of Warwick. And my God, was it dull.
What, even duller than the army?
It was. You had to check the application forms, make sure that the students were earning enough money and stuff like that, if you want to let them on the distance learning MBA. But that it got better very quickly, and the job expanded, and I worked in admissions. And
so how many different jobs did you have at Warwick then, during your time there?
I worked the distance learning MBA, then I was working at the undergraduate admissions, then I had a broader portfolio around undergraduate students more generally, their administration and planning, resource allocation. Then I finished as director of the research development office.
So about kind of four or five different roles. We overlapped a bit, which we'll come on to in a sec, but I had seven jobs during my time there in eight years.
Yeah.
And I mean, one of the strengths of the Warwick model was the moving people around, although, you know, it's something some people are sceptical about, but actually, for those who are the ones who are getting the varied experiences, it's incredibly valuable, and it's certainly getting that variety of roles I certainly found massively beneficial.
And you don't know at the time that's what's going on. I guess it's similar to civil servants.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think what was distinctive about the Warwick model is that you had the senior managers, people, you know, registrar, Mike Shattuck downwards, were all engaged in a process of identifying talent and then moving them in order to help them to grow. And that was a very, very conscious process. And it's something that I think, you know, that could happen in Warwick at that time and before then, but it's really difficult to replicate now.
It is, it's very difficult.
And I don't know about you, I mean, it's certainly something I've tried here at Nottingham on a number of occasions success.
We should plug Ambitious Futures.
Certainly Ambitious Futures, you know, is a response to that challenge, yeah. And does offer at least some opportunity to gain different experiences within two institutions.
When did you start at Warwick?
So I started at Warwick in 1998 and then stuck around until 2006. So we overlapped, I think, for about 3 years.
Yeah, I left in 2001.
Yeah. And, I really enjoyed my time at Warwick, although I genuinely never felt at home there. It's slightly because I was commuting from Nottingham every day, and I wasn't hanging around for social activities. I just went in, did my job, and came home. I didn't feel I was really, you know, a kind of part of it.
Yeah.
And I must admit, all the kind of talk of the Warwick way and, you know, what's special and different about Warwick, I did kind of recoil from originally, because I thought, I just don't think this is my experience. I don't think it's right. And also, what the thing I didn't like about it, and it had many strengths, which I realise in hindsight, many strengths. I there was an attitude towards the most junior members of staff, secretarial and clerical staff, which was really quite dismissive and critical. And there was an incredibly hard ceiling between those on the most junior grades and those in the more senior administrative professional grades, where it was impossible almost to break through from one to the other.
That's a good point. And yeah, it was. I remember the analogy being the difference between the non-commissioned officers and officers.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't move from being a or very, very few people, I don't know what it's like these days, could move from being a sergeant to a lieutenant. Because a lieutenant had been to public school and the sergeant hadn't, basically, and it's probably similar these days. And so you had as you say, what would now be grade 5 staff, who couldn't move to grade 6 because that's where you put the early career lieutenants, who were going to go on and become the majors and the brigadiers and that.
Yeah.
And that certainly isn't the case now. But I know when I was at Birmingham, it became more of a problem, that barrier.
And it was a real barrier, and I think the attitudes towards those, you know, people on the other side of the barrier was really, you know, at times quite offensive, and I really recoiled from that. There were many good things about it, not least the mobility issue, the variety of opportunity, the kind of the sense of, you know, dynamism and possibility. And I mean, I think, you know, one of the landmark events in my time, something we worked together on, was the Clinton visit back in 2000, where the university had something like 8 days' notice that Bill Clinton was going to come there and do his final foreign, you know, policy address at the University of Warwick. And, you know, God knows why he picked Warwick, but anyway, that's what happened. And you know, we had 8 days to prepare for it. And I think you and I were on kind of crowd recruitment. You know,
yeah, we had to get the
fill the Butterworth
in.
Hall, didn't we, with students? And that was the aim. We were just kind of making it up as we went along, weren't we?
That was good. That was it showed how the administration, when it works together, and it can work very fast, and you could pull something off like that. Yeah, no, that was good.
And it was a huge kind of team effort, and it was just crazy. And
I'm glad I wasn't organising it, because I remember thinking, God knows how we're going to pull this off. I'm glad I've only got this little job here.
I felt exactly the same way, because we were in the Senate chamber, I think, you know, with kind of loads of computer emailing people and trying to just sort stuff out for the guest list, and you know, the senior people were all meeting on a kind of constant basis with security forces and you know, US presidential advisors in the room next door, and just kept coming in and out looking utterly harassed the whole time and everything kept changing kind of constantly. So I kept thinking, thank God I'm not part of that.
And I think that's the sometimes the downside of a more senior position. I know this sounds ridiculous, but sometimes it's nice not to know exactly what's going on, just to be able to do your bit.
It certainly is. But I mean, I did find Warwick, you know, ultimately to be a very dynamic environment, and you know, some really great colleagues. Obviously, not just you. You know, there were other people as well. But
they're still around most of them.
But and of course, many people who've kind of progressed through and gone on to be registrars, and obviously, you know, kind of Mike Shattuck takes and deserves enormous credit for that. And he, you know, he did kind of create a cadre of people who did go on to be registrars, all of whom have tried to emulate him in some way since then. But the things that I remember about Warwick, one of the things was, you know, the pink copies of memos, because obviously everything was written or typed rather, and you had kind of multiple copy hard copies of everything, and you did a pink copy of everything you wrote, and it went into a folder which the registrar reviewed on a Friday to make sure that, you know, you'd been a good boy or girl. And I find that utterly bizarre that he would sit there and go through the details of what had been written.
There was a lot, and that's where we all learnt to prepare a set of minutes.
Yes, absolutely.
And because you sat with somebody, another colleague, so a tutor, and you learnt from another person, and you'd get your first draft back heavily annotated, normally with red pen. That was the style. But over time, you learn how to craft a minute. And it sounds a bit daft, but the challenge with what we see today, you said, sounds like an old grumpy old man, is that if they're not succinct and quick, nobody reads them. So you kind of weaken the legislative basis on which you're taking decisions. You weaken the history that tells you why a decision was taken. And it affects the quality of the decision making if you can't record meetings in an accurate and concise way.
We'll come back to this, right? Because I think it's a hugely important issue, and I mean, and it is an art which has been largely lost from today's young administrators. we do sound pretty old and grumpy, but I think we've got a right to. Just finally, then, on the Warwick issue, and you know, a lot of people came through that. It felt like a pretty command and control environment to me. It was quite directive, although one did have an enormous amount of freedom to, you know, to fail, and I failed quite a lot, but nevertheless felt supported in failing.
Whether you felt the same when you started, was when you were first going to get called into a meeting with some professors. Professors, my goodness, do I speak? If anything I say, you know, will I be revealed as a kind of lunatic or something? And it was very intimidating until you actually were in the meetings, and obviously Mike encouraged us to speak, and we had to take. And you knew you did know things, and you could speak out, and they weren't all intimidating. Some of them were clods, but plenty enough of them were just very entertaining and interesting colleagues. But it was very, I can remember being worried about going to these meetings.
Yeah, but it was, I've hugely valued my time at Warwick and did enjoy it immensely, and it was really hard work, but it was a really great development arena at that time, and
you didn't know until afterwards.
Well, no, you didn't really know until afterwards. No, and you know, moving on from one job to the next within the space of 9 months did feel, you know, often like you think you've only just worked out what the hell you're doing, and suddenly you're being asked to do something completely different. On the other hand, it was a fantastic opportunity.
Yeah, I certainly agree. I enjoyed my time, and that moving around was invaluable.
Yeah.
Subsequently.
Yeah. We'll talk more in due course about other things to do with the life of the registrar, but for the moment we'll stop there and just reflect on, you know, what a great job it is working in higher education. I'm sure you'd agree with me, Dave. There's nothing better than working in a university, but basically you've only done the army, and
it's better than freezing your nuts off in a trench.
And I've only ever worked in a pub, so it's better than both of those things. So I think we can agree on that. Well, until next time, thanks ever so much then, Dave.
Thank you, Paul.
That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course, and if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until the next time.